Okay, welcome everyone to our afternoon, our second of our afternoon sessions. It is a large room. I know I've done this once already, but if anybody wants to move down, feel free. My name's Julie McCandless. I'm from the law school here at LSE, and it's my pleasure to welcome you here to what I think is a fantastically named session, Feminism and the Knowledge Factory. And we have three colleagues from the University of Sussex, from the Centre for Higher Education and Equity Research, which the shortened version of which is CHEER. And if anybody would like to cheer throughout the session, do feel free, because I think it's going to be great. So we have three speakers, and we're going to go in reverse order to what's in the booklet, but the order on the slide here. So our first speaker this afternoon is going to be Louise Morley, who's going to speak to us about researching the future, closures and culture wars in the knowledge economy. And I'll just get your PowerPoint, Louise.
Is that my microphone? Thank you very much, Julie. Well, good afternoon, everybody, and it's my intention this afternoon to try and trouble the whole concept of how neoliberalism has been applied to the research economy, the knowledge economy. And let's look at, first of all, some provocations that exist in relation to neoliberal and austerity research economies. So let's start by asking some very obvious questions. Who now is defining the field of social research? Who are these standard makers? And what are the dispersed control practices that might exist? And so a very big question about what are the epistemic exclusions? Now, I travel the world in my job, and I hear all the time about the importance of partnerships and how we must create global research collaborations and the notion about a gestalt, that if we put our very best thinkers and researchers together, we'll get this massive premium at the end of it. But one of the concerns I have about that is this acceleration of the global could be promoting a kind of rationalisation of the social world. Then, of course, I would suggest there might be dangers of normative reproduction and intellectual closures in a global economy. And are we returning to the 70s? Are we going back to the future? Are we getting back to the paradigm wars and the certainties of scientism? And then is the gold standard of research methods now the randomised control trial? Okay, so I'd like to suggest that we have an economics imperialism now in the research economy, and research has been colonised by the global circuits of capitalism. And knowledge, the only value for knowledge now is its use value, is its exchange value. It's been instrumentalised, and its use value, as we've heard from the impact agenda, has to be quantified. So research is more and more linked to government priorities. You're more likely to get funding if you're looking at issues like security or climate change, or post-conflict, etc., than if you're interested in looking at counter-hegemonic areas. So non-economic scholarship could be becoming unfundable or unknowable. Where is it in this new economics imperialism? And as Judith Butler suggested, counter-hegemonic or critical scholarship could be in danger of becoming socially illegitimate. How do you demonstrate value of feminist research within the terms of engagement in the new impact agenda? So I'm suggesting then that it's all about value and not values. And research productivity has been reduced to income generation. So the only value now of research isn't scholarship, it's not discovery or creativity, it's about how much income you can generate for your school, or your department or faculty. It's also being used, it's being reduced to an indicator for performance management. It's a calculative practice. practice. We heard earlier this morning about how the digital economy is being used to make us all calculable. There are figures, there are statistics, probably on every one of us who works in the universities in Britain. But it's also an exchange in the global prestige economy. The global league tables are major aspirational frameworks for individuals, for organisations, for whole national economies. And research is a major indicator in those. There's this, also this ghastly term about innovation that gets used all the time. It reminds me of Raymond Williams' notion of hooray words. Nobody can be against innovation, but it's very hard to deconstruct because it's so loaded. But what is happening is that all activity for research has to be reduced to a common managerial metric. So you can't do research unless it has been financialised and can be realised within the dominant accounting system. And of course, impact is very much part of that. So some questions are then, where's creativity? Where's discovery? Where's pleasure? Passionate engagement? Where's intellectual contribution? And of course, where is social justice? Now, one of the debates this morning was about the tank, you know, the Tiananmen Square metaphor. And one of the problems I had with that image is that it assumes somehow that neoliberalism has this material externality, that it's something that can be located and fought. And one of the arguments I wish to make is that neoliberalism gets internalized, and to use Foucault's notion, you know, it speaks us. It's the discourse speaks us. We interiorize it, we internalize it, and it's more and more difficult to see it as an object which can be combated and controlled. And I think one of the assemblages of regulation is that of peer review. And like a lot of other innovations, to use that ghastly word, it's often purported to be a democratizing innovation, intervention, like open access publishing, for example. But it actually disguises what Kicker used to talk about in terms of steering at a distance. But it's a measuring apparatus, and it's constituted through norms, practices, and epistemologies. And once again, digital technology has been harnessed. It's used, it circulates disembodied and deterritorialized feedback. I have received a feedback on an ESRC application, and it was in a do not reply email. There was nobody on the end of it. There was no customer care. There was no thank you for applying or whatever. It was just these are the reviews and do not reply. So there is something about the distance that's being created in peer review that is extremely sinister. So scarce resources seem to be quite capriciously allocated by non-accountable and non-transparent processes. We talked recently in Cheer to a member of the ESRC committee who was saying she's horrified at some of the language, some of the vocabulary that's used to dismiss grants. For example, people saying, I don't like it, or it didn't grab me, it didn't interest me. So these completely capricious responses are being used to reject applications. I also think that we have this very contradictory set of discourses about collaboration and competition. So, for example, we're constantly told to create international partnerships, co-author, collaborate. And there's this assumption that there's an imagined epistemic community with shared values, shared epistemologies, shared methodologies, who are open to anybody and everybody coming in on their particular research projects. There's nothing there about the perils of competition. And in peer review, there's this notion that externality represents some kind of objectivity, but we're working in highly resource-constrained economies. So if you sign off a grant to another organisation, you are handing over competitive advantage. The peer reviewers also determine what remains outside of the domain of intelligibility. And a question I would pose is whether the peer review procedure has been captured by hegemony. And if you look at the kind of reviews that you receive, which voices gain dominance, are dominant in the decision-making process? So recently I had it sounds like I'm giving you a whole catalogue of miseries here, but recently I had some feedback where five people said, yes, yes, fund it. The introducer came in and said, no, I don't like it, don't fund it. Now, which voice got heard out of all of those voices? So what does peer review do in the neoliberal research economy? Now, another question, related question, is what does research do to academic identities? Well, it produces a whole range of contradictory emotions. Pride is one, when you win. It also produces material rewards and resources, and often leads to leadership. It allows people to ascend the occupational hierarchy, and many of the global leaders of universities have come up because they excelled in research. It also credentialises, and it's an accumulation of highly portable academic capital, like the transfer market in football. So research success, then, equals the good life. And again, back to this tank, this tank metaphor this morning, there are people who benefit from neoliberalism. The metaphor of the tank suggested neoliberalism was the oppressor and we're all the victims. The oppressors are all around us. It's not an externality. They are everywhere. And people who benefit by performing the neoliberal project. But I wish to suggest that there's a major affective ecology linked to the research economy. And a dominant feeling, whereas pride if you win, a dominant feeling is shame. And this gets mobilised via a calculus of success, or, as Bill Cook talked about, management by numbers. And there's a very powerful relationship between shame and indebtedness. So it's not enough now simply to be an academic, because you have to demonstrate that you can earn your income. You are in debt simply by being employed. And if you're not getting, if you're not capturing grants, then you're a bit like the senior members of the Eskimo communities, you know, that you're using up valuable resources that could be put somewhere else. So really you should be left out in the snow somewhere. But shame is individualising. It's the failure. It's about failure to win grants or publish. But it's also collective. And the whole idea is to try and harness people's personal desires for the good of the collective. And the collective, of course, is either progress in eliminating social problems, but more importantly in the neoliberal project is the fear of falling down the global league tables. So every organisational member is responsibilised with keeping the university, getting them into the league tables, keeping them there or getting them higher. And as Braidotti said, we have a culture of governance by fear. And this is something we rarely talk about. It seems absolutely a disqualified discourse, to use Foucault's Foucauldian term, the impact of impact on affect and what that does to academic identity. So Foucault, can we invoke him to help us deconstruct these corrosive micropolitical experiences and governmentalities that are symptomatic of broader cultural clashes and the closure of counter-hegemonic discursive space in the global research economy? Well, yes, I think we can, but I think we have to build on Foucault. And one of the many criticisms of Foucault was that he disqualified the discourse of gender, and I think we need to build on Foucauldian analysis to get a more gendered, nuanced understanding of what's happening. There are so many people we could call upon, but just for the purposes of this brief presentation, I'd like to invoke Laurent Berlon, who talks about cruel optimism. And this is this knotty tethering to objects, scenes, modes of life that generate so much overwhelming yet sustaining negation. So why do we stay attached to objects that are not making us thrive? And there's this faith that adjustment to certain forms and practices of living and thinking will secure one's happiness. Okay, well, as far as she's concerned, academic desire could be stupid optimism, to use a technical term. Researchers are positioned as supplicants for diminishing but highly targeted public resources. And this involves participation in self-frustrating and punitive funding regimes. There's also this logic of relationality. I mean, was it last year, the success rate in my discipline for ESRC grants was 3%. So for every winner, there are many, many, many losers. Yet everybody feels they can decode, deconstruct the game, calculate and win. And then there's this empty signifier of excellence that's invoked. And the value indicators are unstable, they're transitory, they're contingent, and they're contextualized. And Helen Colley has recently used Bourdieu's concept of illusio to critique impact. And there's this idea that we have to invest in the game, which involves relentless performativity. And yet, the game seldom leads to acquisition or success. Still, we keep playing it. Moving on from the gameplay, the ludic engagement with the research economy, let's look a bit at epistemic exclusions and the precarious academics. So if academic identity is so based on research success, and research success is precarious, what does this do to the precarious academics? Okay, well, a big question then is who is deemed capable of reason and who's cast as reliable or unreliable knowers? Well, according to UNESCO, 71% of researchers globally are men. And when they talk about researchers, they don't mean people working on research projects, okay? They talk about principal investigators. And only 29% are women. Women are less likely to be journal editors, cited in top-rated journals. They're less likely to be principal investigators in Europe. They're less likely to be on research boards. They're less likely to be awarded large grants. In the UK, the RCUK, who we have pressured for the last couple of years into compiling gender disaggregated statistics and acting upon them, not simply reporting it, demonstrated that across all age and grant categories, women average 25% success rate compared with men's 29%. Women are also less likely to be awarded research prizes. I don't know if any of you have ever been to the Nobel Museum in Stockholm, but you'll see Marie Curie and Doris Lessing and a few other women, but not many. And less likely to be keynote conference speakers. Okay, well, just quickly to turn to some work that I've been doing for the British Council. I realise evidence is a highly problematic term, but there's some global work that I've been doing with questionnaires and focus groups from women across these different countries. And they've been asked about leadership and what attracts them, what enables them, etc. And invariably they talk about women's precarious relationship with the research economy as a huge barrier to organisational leadership. And to sort of summarise a very complex set of findings, there's a circular relationship between the exclusion of groups from prestigious relay points in the knowledge economy and the reproduction of norms in that define that field. Now, I don't wish to essentialise women, because women can be good little neoliberals too, but there is something about how privilege gets reproduced and embedded into all the research processes. So what were they saying if we unpack the research processes? They were talking about opaqueness in decision-making, lack of transparency, lack of accountability of funders, gender bias in assessment of excellence, and that's been going on for a very long time. The Venerus and Vold study in Sweden started the big debate several decades ago. And then a big area is how there's a gender division of labour and horizontal segregation, with women frequently tasked with inward-facing domestic-type work rather than the outward-facing research and international work. Then there are a multitude of institutional practices which impede research research progress, like short-term contracts and domestic responsibilities. And then again, something that's becoming very noticeable is the privileging of STEM in research. And STEM, as we know, tends to be male-dominated. And women globally have negotiated and are taking this forward, a manifesto for change. And just for the purposes of this session, one of the big areas that women are calling for change is the global league tables, that we revisit the indicators and not just, we don't separate equality from quality as if they're on two separate trajectories, but we put equality indicators into the global league tables. And then maybe organisations will start taking it seriously if there's some financial leverage. So, okay, well, why does any of this matter? So what is this impact on the research cultures? So research makes the world intelligible in specific ways and contributes to the foreclosure of other patterns of intelligibility. What we're finding is there's a beneficence of the state patronage is only available for those sharing the values of new times. And the people who do share the new times values are doing very well. Hence, they're not likely to get out and attack the tanks. And a big question, really, is how to defend the autonomy of the field of the production of research against heteronomy and control practices that masquerade as democratisation. So, how do we make it an alternativity imaginable? And how can social science research researchers trouble neoliberalism? And again, I think what Wendy Brown was saying is it is incoherent. There are spaces and opportunities for resistance. How to resist being co-opted by narrow policy research agendas, how to inform policy with evidence and not vice versa, how to challenge and expose increasing socioeconomic inequalities and exclusions, how to reinvigorate knowledge production as a site of transformation and possibility, and as Helen Colley said, how do we act as Socratic gadflies and keep asking these difficult and awkward questions? How do we transgress and re-signify and rework these tired, stale categories and vocabularies? How do we avoid this dead and deadening a language of excellence, innovation, quality, etc.? And can we identify new optics for viewing the social world that aren't linked to financialization and scores and calculabilities? And most importantly, I think this morning there was a question about critique, and I think that's something we're extremely good at in academic life. We're less effective at imagining the future, at futurology. So we're very good at saying what's wrong with the current status quo. What we don't say is what we'd like to see and how we'd like to get there. So my suggestion is we try to imagine and research the future that you want to see. Thank you very much.
So thank you, Louise. That was fantastic to start us off. We're now moving on to Professor Valerie Hay, who's going to talk about dissident daughters, which sounds great.
Thanks very much, Louise, and thank you to the chair. The question mark's significant in more ways than one. I mean, in this symposium, we are asking about the conditions of our own production as feminist academics. We are thinking with and against Foucault. He saw in neoliberal governmentality the logic of rendering everything for sale, to make the market into the social, with the effect of reducing and indeed compelling every relation as a relation of competition. In this bleak scenario, what might it be possible to think of as academic feminist resistance when dissensus, a.k.a. Foucault, or counter-discourse seems such a terse little thing to think against the implacable, the seeming implacable, neoliberal order of things? I've had recourse to an unreconstructed humanism, to other ways that human does the human as fleshy emotional subjects, even as I know we are now post-human, and most certainly theoretically humanism is very infradic. I may never in this presentation resolve this longing for a guarantor of a human subject as a solution to the crisis we are invested in thinking about. So my subtitle, The Psychic Life of Academic Feminism, it speaks to about that kind of longing, to the psychic economy of an academy where feminist power is figured, it's done, and it's undone. So translating down from high abstraction to my own self, this presentation carries the effects of being stuck. I will literally go around in circles, or perhaps of coming unstuck as a feminist and an academic. It's an exploratory effort to think out of the stickiness of that space of being stuck. If becoming subject is to take yourself up also as an object, that actually means the production of a subjectivity that is a self-evaluating one. I currently slide around how becoming a feminist academic subject makes for an endless attacking guilty conscience. It's as if my feminist subjectivity fights it out and loses ground all the time with my competitive neoliberal subjectivity. Neither forces itself upon me, apparently, but seduces me as part of a whole spectrum of passionate attachments. I suppose I am trying to reconsider the psychic life of my feminism as travelling from what I imagine it used to be as a liberating subject position to it now becoming a berating of my failures. Or put another way, how academic feminism is a contradictory space of competitive dissensus making, but in the meantime, the boys' band metaphor plays on. Thus, the question mark that punctuates the title carries psychosocial dread, fears that interpose on and as my subjectivity, and it keeps chastising me. Is it still possible, if it ever was, to be a dissident daughter of feminism in the academy? And that bundles into a whole package, a whole assemblage about fears and worries and stresses and strains, that resistance is not bearable and possible, even as I know the weight of all my reading in post-structural theory tells me it is so. There is the ambiguous subject of subjection and agency, but it often feels like this subject who is struggling for a livable life, it's a very lonely planet, a very lonely place of no place. And that the academy is simultaneously the place of resistance. And I don't really know how to weigh and evaluate this fabulous work. But it also talks about precisely that internality-externality dialectic that Louise insists on. That's how neoliberalism works. It governs us. The governmentality isn't out there. It's through us. It's through all kinds of interstices of the self and her or his desires. So, you know, is our feminism suboptimal, even though it's fantastic critique, which is another way of saying, is critique enough? And moreover, that even talking about the academy as being governed, again, my conscience, is itself an indulgence compared to the more pressing materialism of class, which is massively under neoliberal orders, reorganising and reproducing and densifying and deepening a gendered and racialised super precariat with zero contract workers who earn their own poverty. We are also aware of living within the immiseration of geopolitics in countless theatres of violence. So talking about ourselves as produced in a privileged space is deeply awkward. So to overcome what I've characterised as an apocalyptic scene in a way, don't we need a materialism we buy, not the mousy little thing masquerading in discourse? So it's questioning our theoretical tools to think with the new conditions of materialism, at the same time as questioning the logic of feminist theorising itself, which, wrapped up in the circuits of exchange and value, constantly looking for the next best thing, something that Barbara's going to pick up on. Moreover, how can feminist professors, being privileged, claim to know anything about those 0 hours working in their own academy, let alone anywhere else? So is the reflexive turn, which I'm doing here in a series of spirals, doesn't it turn you into, or out of, into a dead end of confession and identity politics? If it is the case that neoliberalism regulates our conditions of academic productivity, as Louise has beautifully illustrated, or it seeks to, and that the university is a site where there's been a systematic erasure of purposes other than those servile to the market, doesn't this render any critique we do almost redundant? I mean, what are we for? What authority can we muster to speak? So the sticky problematic that I have been nagging myself with, and that nags me, is what might it be possible to think of as academic feminist resistance? So if I take as evidence, and even that word, the demand for evidence, irritates me. It's a siren song of a symbolic order that refuses the evidence of its own relation of ruling. I am left with my own feminist academic identity and what I understand of how I see the world, the optics, the literature I read, the conversations I have, the writing I read, the writing I co-author. And what I understand of evidence of massive, assaultative, gross inequality, and the evacuation of the university almost as the space to resist, to articulate any counter-discourses. And it leaves a sense of dismay and disappointed, beyond disappointment, stuckness, to which I pose the reflexive circling question again, what the hell can one do? And I'll keep coming back to this like a toothache, if you can bear it. There will be some PowerPoints later. So my questions are, and they're bundled in other questions, what do feminist words do and what desires lie there? In sum, is feminist academic desire nostalgic or redundant? So what you may ask, but it feels to me, and I use the word advisedly, that being put on the shores of having to work out what Foucault says, what is the main danger, it compels some understanding about a sense of inertia, inactivity, complicity. I mean, all the words that are used in, I think, a way that we need to unpack and deconstruct, not assume, are self-evident. He says, my point is not that everything is bad, but that everything is dangerous. Not exactly consoling words, these, which is not the same as bad. if everything is dangerous, then we always have something to do. So my position leads not to apathy, but to hyper and pessimistic activism. I think the ethical political choice we have to make every day is to determine which is the main danger. And my quandary being confronted with that, because I returned to Foucault for this symposium event, I am no longer sure that I have any clue as to what is the main danger. And maybe I'm being too literalist here, I probably am. I am mindful of Foucault's elegant work on governmentality. I followed, or more accurately, fell into the post-structural turn at Kent. The contingency of that being the theory at that time in that place. I have been and am endlessly seduced by the notion of discourse as constitutive and subjectivating and as the site for reinscriptive agency. I can definitely feel myself being constituted all the time. But it is by a strange formation of hyperwork that never ever displaces the sense of political inertia. A paradoxical rendering of a political subject as an academic feminist, but not politically mattering. I don't want to stay there. I want to think myself forward, and I want to join in conversations about thinking forward. Futurology, in Louise's elegant phrase. I know I can't even begin to do this unless I at least recognise the conditions of my own production. I think this inertia or temptation about it, it traces a struggle to think historically outside of a form of temporality that always organises things as a before and an after. And in the context of feminism, that's a dead end. As Kathy Davis notes, citing Claire Hemmings, this method of historiography is problematic because it's unreflexive and myopic. And she goes on, according to Hemmings, representing feminist history in terms of generation always entails separating the good girls from the bad and therefore allows the creation of a space for more adequate, more appropriate feminist subject. Always, as it happens, to be the one who is speaking now. Thus, following this framing of feminist history as one of progress, we have moved away from the misguided essentialism of the 70s to embrace the postmodern concept of identity and a Foucauldian notion of power. And more recently, on the horizon, a new generation has emerged who sees materialism as a way to save us from the excesses and mistakes of the past, and so on and so forth. Okay, I will get happier. It will get happier. It isn't all gloomy doomy, but I do think you have to stick there sometimes with that gloomy doomy. Louise posed a question sometime in Cheer, the question of why bother, in the context of endless of that stuff. And I think I replied, yeah, who cares? And I think we had both looked around at our manic activity and we asked ourselves, what did it amount to beyond feeding the matrix, you know, pleasuring the machine, as that phrase has it. And this was a sort of downbeat, kind of politically depressing semi-conclusion. So how could Foucault, how could he apparently hold the idea of danger at bay by the apparent self-cancelling notion of hyperactive pessimism? But then he was, as I understand it, outside the university. And I fear in speculating out loud about the situation that I am reading very much as an embodied subject in a material space that is doing things to me at the level of the affective and the intellect and the affective. I think those things are two sides of the same paper, like knowledge power. I feel I've got the theory wrong, 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 and the politics even wronger. Yet I know There is no way to locate thinking otherwise. I know there is a way. I haven't given up entirely to think otherwise. And I can't stop considering sociality and solidarity as potentiated, self, other, and agency. And what Terry Lovell calls ensemble agency, because she was questioning Butler's idea of reinscriptive as an individual performative reinscription through language. And she was looking at Butler's account of agency in the famous, iconic moment when Rosa Parks refused to move on the bus. And I'm wondering if there are spaces of possibility for refusing, resisting, recasting now. I'm writing in riddles because I am literally stuck. I want to move outside the authoritative discourse of Foucault, or indeed critique. You know, the will to critique is terribly seductive. You know, if only we get our theories right, you know, life will get better. But I want to make some sort of difference. I mean, in some senses, I want to stop the clock on late and post-modernity. I want to go back to what I imagine in my fantasy life as being a feminist activist. You know, that I could do things. I want to recover hope. I want to claim some humanism, even as I know it's bogus. Part of this travelling in circles is about getting lost, but not in a good way. I don't feel very smart. Those who know Patti Lathers' work will get the very embedded references. I was taken aback recently by, you know, in trying to think to hope. I tried to reimagine the future, but frankly, it looked like a reinvented welfare state, except possibly not as lavish. And I was told there was absolutely no point in thinking at the system level anymore. And, you know, I think the person was absolutely politically right. But I was holding on to that as an absolute unrequited love. So how do you think against the grain? How do you desire differently in your future that Barad says is inherited and thus just as likely to be saturated by neoliberal governmentality with its dissolved sociality and hollowed out commitments? But if this preamble and thinking out loud crafts depressive realism as politics, and it does, it is politics, and it's the politics of difficulty, I suppose we have no choice but to stick with the difficulty. The idea of depressive realism came from Balance encounter with a colleague who had been diagnosed with clinical depression, and everyone kept telling him to get over it, willing the it away. And she turned this into a trope for considering the depressive realities this person was experiencing and living and were living through him. So, in a sense, sticking with the difficulty, sticking with depressive realism, and trying to escape its complete pull captures something of the circlings I've tried to speak about. But of course, not everything you do is measured. In both senses of the word, you can take risks, you can become another kind of subject. My argument that this is only vaguely possible as a combined force stoked by positive affect. I mean, laughter in the face of serious categories is indispensable for feminism. How right she is. And this is now where I turn to FAB, a collectivity that was formed about 10 years ago, and we've had several shows. We've temporarily, we haven't been booked for further shows, but we've had a bit of a downtime, but we're reassembling ourselves with some encouragement. FAB stands for anything you want it to, actually. It's meant to be irreverent. It's meant to provoke a bit of laughter. Laughter, the academy, I know that's dangerous. Feminists against academic bollocks, I think it was initially, which was a bit northern, but then some of us are. But it was a form of action for ourselves. And you might say the binary posing the self as only political when you're doing it on someone else's behalf is entirely to miss the point of both Foucault and Butler. However, we weren't at the gates. The gates we were at were inside the university. And we shared the resources of confidence, because it was took quite a lot of nerve to stand up at conferences and do it differently. We took the mick out of the grids of intelligibility that Louise outlines, through which we're compulsorily compelled to produce ourselves through. And recently, two members of FAB, Kath Lambert and Diane Ray, have written about the practices, about our shows, about our intent, and the joy of having some fun. Austerity and fun, awkward. Academia and fun, even more awkward. Oxymoronic, methinketh. But we did, and I like to think we made fun for others and created some political pleasure. We encouraged people. This is not for my CV, so I'm not going doing this for an audition, but it is to say something that we did things, broke through some of this stuff, turned the optic back on the conditions of our own production. Back to Foucault and his analytics, his genealogy of subject. I suppose this is a space that for the moment one has to lodge the desire and hope for a feminist future. And it's got to be located in dissensus, around the edges. Even as I know those feel very fragile when confronted with what we're suffering, let alone what our society is suffering. We have to reinscribe things. We've got to exploit. You know, neoliberalism isn't a block. It's a series of reinscriptions, modes of intelligibility. And this incessant need for repetitions. Think of all the endless repetitions of all the audits. We have to keep, you know, the police order keeps kind of capturing us, seeking to capture us. It is intrinsically unstable. We have to disturb it, as Louise would say. And we have to think alongside it, pastiche it, undo it, or aiming to unravel it, ideally. But I don't want to set up heroic politics against, you know, treacherous collusion. That is not the way to think about, I think, the political difficulty of keeping in the moment of difficulty. But we have to keep spaces of possibility open for our students. And I like to think of the idea of feminism as a gift, but not a debt that you have to pay back or get right or improve, but to work with and within, and in some instances, undo. But all the better to identify what is the main danger. Our students may know it more confidently than I do, or they may dare to name it as possible of being overcome. Thanks very much.
Valerie, for that really passionate presentation, and we've clearly missed a trick by not having Fab perform this evening. Okay, and now we have Dr. Barbara Crossford. Who's going to talk about materialising Foucault with another question mark.
Well, thank you to you all for being here, and it's a pleasure to be following Louise and Valerie. As a researcher working in education, my contribution to this symposium is to engage with a recurring critique of Foucault's work that I've encountered recently in different contexts. I should say that my own involvement in Foucault's work was completely contingent on me arriving in a department doing a PhD on assessment issues, and finding myself with colleagues who thought about assessment through Foucault's concept of a regime of truth, so that I became immersed in Foucault through doing my doctorate at that time. So this critique is that Foucault reduced everything to language. Sometimes it's everything to discourse, but discourse is understood in a purely representational or linguistic way. So in doing this, Foucault therefore fails supposedly to account for the material realities of our everyday worlds. Even though his work paradoxically offers a very strong critique of this binary understanding of the relationship of words and things, and indeed of what could be called representational epistemologies, i.e. that correct knowledge is about accurately representing an independently existing world. However, I've also been provoked by what might at first sight seem to be similar arguments made by some of those writing now as material feminists. For example, that language has been granted too much power, and that through all the different turns of social science communities, linguistic, semiotic, interpretive, cultural, the only things that do not seem to matter anymore is matter. And there I'm quoting the work of Karen Barad. I would say then that the conference has created for me the possibility of exercising my own demons in responding to these different accusations. I will say that while nevertheless embracing the assertion of the mutual articulation of matter and meaning which Barad's work proposes, I do admit to feeling really perplexed about the place of language in the material nexus, material discursive nexus she posits. So I will, in my presentation, try to explore data from a previous research project that I have done on the doctoral viva voce, with a view to contributing to the kinds of diffractive readings that Barad proposes, and then return with some short reflections on what this new language suggests about our contemporary epistemic climate. But I do want to just visit briefly the contribution of Foucault's work in response to the paradox of this critique that he reduced everything to language. The paradox of this very quickly becomes apparent, given that one of his main contributions was the undoing of representational epistemologies underpinning Cartesian and modern Western thought. He did not engage with gender at all. That's the main critiques of his work. But instead, Foucault's theorization of discourse and the disciplinary practices of modern institutions problematizes the supposed separation of words and things. He also helpfully illuminates the historical contingencies of this as a particular signifying regime, and how, for example, it was only from the age of reason that such an understanding of language emerged. Which there was this expectation of a relationship of correspondence between the signifier, the signifying elephant and element, where is the elephant in the room? signifying element and the signified. So their resemblance and similitude were cast aside as error, banished now to the separate realm of literature and replaced by comparison, measurement and taxonomic categorization. These were now the practices which underpinned the new order of knowledge and the new fields of disciplinary knowledge which emerged at this time. So Foucault's point, of course, is that rather than discovering the world as a pre-existing reality, these processes of knowledge production brought it into being in particular ways, framed by this Western scientific gaze. So rather than the reduction of everything to language, or treating discourses as systems of science, discourses, in his famous formulation, are instead practices that systematically form the objects of which they speak. And this morning, in the discussion of the impact case, we had the most wonderful example of exactly that, how the impact case starts to produce particular discourses, particular subjects, and brings research into being in particular ways. So, As it is also relevant for the short bit of data excerpts that I visit later, where I'm responding to critiques of Foucault's work by Barad, I just mentioned briefly that the episteme of the Age of Reason included, of course, this concept of disciplinary power. So rather than power that was possessed, this involved ensuring an incorporation of power, obtaining productive service from individuals in their concrete lives through the body. And as someone working in education, school discipline, assessment was identified as a particularly efficacious form of discipline with the techniques of surveillance, normalising judgment and examination. And this is relevant for the data that I show later about the Viva Voce. Importantly, however, these disciplinary processes and the fields of knowledge that evolved around this time rendered the individual who was subjected to this conditioning knowable as such, as an individual. So, returning to my initial provocation what is paradoxical is that the installation of these of this particular episteme is still so misrecognized in the critique of Foucault's work. There is a complete disjuncture there in that critique of what Foucault was trying to say. So I suggest then, if we are looking for epistemologies within our contemporary neoliberal regimes, there is something still very much related in place here, a kind of vernacular positivism, as my colleagues at Sussex might call it, in many parts of in many contexts. Of course, there's a multiplicity of ways of knowing the world. But what I feel I meet often is still this assumption of representational epistemology that is still underpinning much of the discourses we are engaging with. Of course, in higher education, we've heard a great deal already about how this we end up with higher education repurposed as an economic good, very much through Foucault made a marvellous contribution in terms of his writing on neoliberal governmentality and how this allowed the production of the neoliberal subject through an intensification of individualisation, the ordering, the coding of the social in terms of the economic, and the representation of this economic coding as already a reality, which contributes also to a depoliticisation of the issues. So, taking up Valerie's points and Louise's as well, of course, we are within this knowledge factory. We cannot be assumed. Our critique is also a critique of ourselves. We are complicit in many ways with this game. So rather than docile bodies, within a neoliberal regime, we are self-actualizing, auditable individuals. So that takes me to my concerns, which are about the knowledge, the epistemologies that we are engaging with in the work that we are trying to do in our own research with our students. And I pick up here on the work of Maggie McClure, who was herself responding to Patty Lather's work, where she talked about working the ruins of older foundational understandings of research. A more recent article by Maggie McClure looks back and says, well, what damage was actually done? Are we not still working very much with the old practices, research practices, in terms of, she gives examples of the excavation of themes and codes from our data, the way grounded theory still might resonate in different quarters of the academy, the expectations that we can produce certainties rather than the more fluid understandings of knowledge within post-structural theory. So she turns back the gaze on qualitative research to find, in fact, little change. So, encouragingly, of course, things. What I am now moving on to is my response to Karen Barad, because here we do have suddenly a new language for engaging with a new optic, it has been called, that has proved very productive in research conducted by colleagues. I think of special edition of Gender and Education that Carol Taylor and Gabrielle Evenson led, taking up the a gentle realism of Karen Barad. So this proposes a new onto epistemology. It's very much her work comes, I'm sure you'll know, from a fusion of different fields. Her background in quantum physics, her work is a product of a reading of the work of Niels Bohr, the quantum physics quantum physicist, and bringing this together in what she calls a diffractive reading of both Foucault and Butler, to propose this new onto-epistemology and the notion of a post-humanist performativity. So a new set of language tools, I would say, phenomena, apparatus, and a boundary making, the differential cutting of our worlds through by apparatus, through what she calls agential cuts. Now, part of her work is to take up the critique by Foucault and others of what she uses the term representational epistemologies, the idea that language represents an objective, externally knowable reality, and we're looking for that to fit in the best possible way. But a major part, another important part of her critique is that in the work of Foucault and also Judith Butler, the material has been neglected, and that language has been overprivileged. So as she says, language has been granted too much power. Language matters, discourse matters. There is an important sense in which the only thing that does not seem to matter anymore is matter. So it's interesting to find, well, I suppose I just want to analyse my own reaction to this. I would first of all say that my understanding of discourse has the material already within it. It's something that, so when I hear, for example, her terms, a material discursive, she hyphenates them, I find myself thinking, well, is the material not actually in the discursive? I found myself prompted then to go back to Foucault, and that's what I have done earlier in my presentation, to say, how is the material implicated in Foucault's work? And what I tried to show earlier on, that his work is hugely about the production of the body through disciplinary practices. So I do find that Foucault does is very much the material. Is hugely part of what he is about. So I do agree with Maggie McClure here that there is a tendency in the work of material feminists to conflate language and discourse, although Barad herself recognises at different points that language and discourse are not the same. Discourse is not a synonym for language. She also recognises that Foucault's analytical power links discursive practices to the body. But she does say that she finds Foucault fails to offer an account of the body's historicity, in which its very materiality plays an active role in the working of power. Here, I suppose, I'm prompted to ask if Foucault's point may not have rather been his wider analysis of the effects of disciplinary power was precisely to produce this separation. In other words, the individuation of the humanist self as such, in ways that marked out, intensified, and normalised the subject-object distinction. And Foucault, for example, going back to his work, early work, Discipline and Punish, his analysis of the techniques of the institutions of modernity and their disciplinary practices, he comments that a meticulous observation of detail and at the same time a political awareness of these small things for the control and use of men emerged through the classical age, bearing with them a whole set of techniques, a whole corpus of methods and knowledge, descriptions, plans and data. And from such trifles, the man of modern humanism is born. So there is Foucault's optic, for me, is about the production, exactly the production of these of the subject. The subject is not a subject in language. It is an embodied subject shaped through these disciplinary practices, but individuated through processes such as the examination. And as we go into our audit culture now, we have the multiple metrics through which we are individuated and produced as that individual as well. Barad was also resistant to the power attributed to language in Butler's Bodies That Matter. Where Butler says, for example, "Ah, it's a girl," and Butler picks out this interpolation as being at once the setting of a boundary and also the repeated inculcation of a norm. Barad picks up on Butler's short parenthesis in that discussion, where she says, "The sonogram notwithstanding, a technology, the ultrasound technology, which of course might like to allow you to see the sex of a fetus at an earlier point than at the birth. So the sonogram notwithstanding," but Barad picks up on this and says, "Ah, you know, we cannot just dismiss the material in this way." And she has develops an argument around the significance of the sonogram as an apparatus which allows the differential bringing into being of our social worlds. But her focus is on the sonogram as an apparatus, arguing for the importance of that of the material, and suggesting that Butler did not sufficiently recognise the material. So what I wanted to do was to try to explore this language in terms of research data that I, a project I was involved in earlier, on the doctoral viva voce. First of all, I try to identify what might be an apparatus in the context of that that work. Sorry, I should realise I should move that forward. I wanted to see what could be seen as an equivalent to the sonogram as apparatus, and I wanted to see how the material, how language was implicated in the event. And I could not find an equivalent of the sonogram. There are multiple texts that are involved and multiple textual practices. Obviously, there are the examiner's reports. There's a set of questions. There is the questioning. All of these practices are thoroughly, language, the material, discourse, are thoroughly enmeshed. I found it very difficult to separate out in the way that Barad does when she focuses on the sonogram as an apparatus. I found it difficult in this event how I could translate this. This is a very short bit of data from an interview with a doctoral graduate, where she talked about her nerves. I mean, it resonates with the affective, it resonates with the embodied ways that how matter and meaning and language are wholly implicated in each other, intersect with each other. It's the other aspect of this quotation for me that is important is how the inculcation of norms through earlier assessment practices are so important in shaping her experience of this event. So I found myself finding here Judith Butler's arguments much more useful for understanding this data. Obviously, we need theories of affect here as well. I'm not saying that all of this is, the complexity of this is Foucault does not have a theory for me of affect. It's something that we need to go beyond Foucault for this. So I am probably quite close to my time, so I am going to conclude, move that, just to say thank you to Karan Barad and of course to Foucault for the provocation, for a new language which encourages attention to the materialities of the production of our research knowledges and our co-implication in this. For this onto-epistemology that resists the individualization of contemporary neoliberal regimes, but also for provoking the questions about the extent that the materialities of language seem intrinsic to interaction and how this becomes meaningful. It does leave me still with the question of how in this material discursive mangle of interaction we can account for language. And I think I would argue that more diffractive work is needed. Can a speech act not function in terms of an apparatus itself? I suppose my final concern is that by stripping out the attention in this material discursive hyphenated construction, it seems important that for me that there would be a theory of language that allows that retains a space for difference, because that is a space. I mean, that's in terms of, for example, Butler's notion of performative contestation. That space is really important for maintaining the possibility of resignification, and also therefore for the retaining a sense, a political consciousness, I suppose. So I'll stop there.
can invite Louise and Valerie back up to the stage, please. Okay, so thanks for three really great and really thought-provoking presentations. Lots of questions in there. So we've got 20 minutes for discussion, comments, general questions. Jacob has the... Have I got your name right? Jacob? Yeah, has the microphone. So if you could just sort of wave your hand at me when you have you want to speak, that would be great.
This is more a thought than a question. So I really enjoyed all of your contributions, and I think that the focus on affect is particularly helpful for me. In relation to this question of what do we do, and like how do we deal with the fact that it's depressing and that we have these sort of internal contradictions, I've been thinking a lot about this recent book, The Queer Art of Failure, Jack Halberstam's book, and particularly, I guess I didn't know what to do with the book when I read it, and we had a feminist reading group on it, and none of us really knew what the politics of that was. Like, okay, so we can get used to the idea that by these criteria we're failing all the time, but what do we do? And I saw a presentation by Jack Halberstam a few months ago on it, in which essentially, in response to a question from the audience saying, well, our students can't afford to fail with this much debt. How do we respond to that? And Jack's response was, your students can't afford to succeed. If their success goal is that they're going to go off to law school and come out with $100,000 in debt, and then they're going to be required to take a corporate job that makes them miserable, that has no security at the end of it, like, you can't afford to succeed on those terms. So I'm wondering about whether there is some space for reclaiming failure, or at least some vision of that. And it also, your description of, what was it, FAB, made me think of the Journal of Universal Rejection, which is a sort of satire on this whole process. And one of the things it says on there is, you may claim to have submitted to the most prestigious journal, judged by acceptance rate. So that this necessity of failure is part of what makes neoliberalism succeed. It's part of what constitutes success. So I wonder if there's a feminist politics of, you know, something like the Journal of Universal Rejection, of reclaiming what it means to be rejected or to fail on these terms.
Well, I thank you very much for the question. I don't know the work of the person mentioned, so we'll collect that for our archives to survive with failure, in inverted commas, back in cheer. I think that's I love that idea. You know, I love it because it speaks to my own intellectual history as an 11 plus failure. But in a sense, you know, I was lucky. Hence my adoration of the welfare state, which is totally misplaced and totally problematic and totally not right. But I can't help feeling grateful and thankful that it was there, precisely because, you know, safety nets and second chances. There was a vocabulary of second chances, you know. There was some way up from out and under. But I absolutely love the idea of deconstructing success. I'm so tempted to... I've thought about it. Show students papers that have got absolutely trashed, absolutely merciless critiques. There is a nice beginning to that. I think Ian Stronach, in one of the education journals, took that on board and talked about, you know, all the failures of all the projects they always submitted. But, you know, in a sense, that's still trapped. It's still trapped within the gaze of the desiring machine of the university as it presently exists. And shifting to people desiring otherwise for themselves. You know, I mean, we've used quite a lot of the work of Lauren Ballant about cruel, you know, Louise cited it, cruel optimism, that sense in which you stay attached to things that you know are not doing you any good. You know, these kind of irrational investments in realities that are not the very best that they could be, but So I think we need to do a lot of thinking about how we might get attached to other things. I'd like to know the methodology of constructing failure as a desirable object. I really, really would. Maybe we can open that up.
Yeah. Yes, just to say, I think feminism and neoliberalism have a very contradictory and complex relationship, and that feminism doesn't equate with failure in neoliberalism. It isn't failed neoliberalism. Just to give you an example of that, I mean, when I was a young academic doing feminist research, feminist writing, it got very easily dismissed and disqualified. I mean, these are the days of women's studies that Mary was one of the pioneers of. Very easily marginalised, ignored, etc. Enter the accounting system, enter the RAE. Some of the feminist journals were the most prestigious journals. Feminists were being returned for the RAE and doing extremely well, getting all our work assessed and appraised very, very positively. So it produced a contradictory set of engagements for feminism. The audit culture has both attacked and has promoted feminist research in the academy. So it's not a simple binary, I think, of neoliberalism's all the winner, where all the winners are, and feminism's where all the failures are. I think it's much, much more complex than that.
Jacob, just up at the... towards the back.
Thank you so much for your papers. I really appreciated them. I just wanted to say to Valerie, I really enjoyed your talk particularly and relate to it very much. Something I am hearing quite a lot is something about the limits of critique and criticism. And actually, I think that's really misplaced. I think that politics is only as good as its criticism. But I do think something that needs to be unpacked more is exactly what you're doing in your work, which is the subject of feminism, so the subject of the critique or the subject of the politics. And obviously Lauren Berlant's really good on this in terms of political emotion and worn-out modes, worn-out genres. But even this morning, at the end of... Gurminder's paper, she talked about our privilege. Mm. And there's something that happens every time you're in an academic space, is that even though there are cursory acknowledgements about how people are differently positioned in the space, so to do with people who might be precariously employed, or that there are lots of students present and so on, there's something about those differences that never seem to make it into the critique. That might be a bit strongly put. But, yes, so I guess it's just a response, really, in terms of something that I think is in the work that you presented, but really needs to be worked on more, like as an object of critique, actually the enunciatory position. And in your paper, you return to yourself, and I find that very effective. But also, certain modes of speaking are already available for you to do that. And there's always this tension around about people finding voice and being listened to in terms of when there aren't those existing conventions there. So thank you for the panel.
Would anybody like to respond to that?
I tried to craft it. I mean, I tried not to do it as vanity publishing, but equally I wanted to put myself in there precisely because of my political analysis about how neoliberalism works in contradiction and in tandem with living as a feminist academic. I think this space of talking about difference is absolutely treacherous. I tried to do it in a way that was historical and suggested certain mobilities, because privilege is not static. Aspiration isn't static. You know, shifting, by its very nature, isn't static. Subjects come from somewhere. They move somewhere. If they're lucky to have certain investments, they get on, quote unquote, in kinder, more socialised investment times. So there's part of me that wants to keep talking about the kinder, socialised times, lest we forget them. And I also feel an obligation to, in some way, to try and craft a different vocabulary, a certain... it's partly a reprimand to myself, and I don't want to keep turning it back to myself, but actually, it seems appropriate to talk about oneself. I mean, this is a conference about governing the academic life or death. I've been in the academy 30 years, and it was one thing and it has become another and it'll become something else. So I don't want to stay silent, but equally I don't want my discourse to silence others. I am genuinely interested in dialogue. We all are. And we engage in it. We might not get the terms of dialogue right. That's what I try to rehearse. If you step into difference, you can. The moment I talk about the academy as a professor, I get told to shut up basically because I'm privileged. So the irony of having a space where you can speak is then turned back against you. The irony of me being powerful to give voice or encourage others is turned back against me because I'm privileged. And I would want to contest that fiercely. Fiercely, fiercely, fiercely. Because privilege, you can use it in very different ways. It's not static. It's not essential. It's not one thing. It can be reinscribed. It can be distributed. You can make it safer. I'm stepping into another treacherous category of self-aggrandizement and how wonderful and lucky me and I'm empowering people. I'm bloody well not. I'm actually trying to empower myself baroquely, because even if you are a professor, there's a website in The Guardian that Academics Anonymous. It's a very intimidating space, even as a professor in the academy, actually. So I think we have to speak, but thoughtfully and reflexively. And we'll always get the reflexivity wrong, because you can never, ever get it right.
Okay, well, we'll take another question, this lady here.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed all of the presentations. It's a question, I suppose, for all of us, but particularly for Louise. And it's a reflection on how I've been feeling recently in relation to my relationship with younger women entering higher education. And it's a question about what are the feminist politics of a futurology? How do we engage young women who are feeling incredibly constrained by the kind of terrain that Louise so eloquently described? What do we do to intervene in those spaces? And I suppose, thinking about Valerie's own reflection on her own position as a feminist scholar in this kind of context, how do we then think about that in relationship to the futurology we might engage in as feminists?
Gosh.
Big one.
Yes, absolutely. Thanks, Penny.
Thank you.
There's a flaw in the argument that we have to redeem and rescue and resolve the contradictions for the next generation. And also I'm aware that there's a huge amount of debate about intergenerational feminism. Mm-hmm. And every generation has to engage and find their own way into it. I don't think any generation has ownership of feminism. And often in debates, that causes tension. You know, the old guard feminists think that theirs was the pure form, and then the more recent, the digital feminism, etc., is the contaminated form, or the popularised form. So I think every age will find its own engagement with feminism. It's not up to us to say we have to create the preconditions for that engagement. But I am conscious, and I think there's a link between what you said, Penny, and the previous question about the recycling of argumentation. And there was something in the previous question that reminded me of the 1980s identity politics that was so prevalent, particularly in this city where I worked at the time in the Greater London Council, and how all the emancipatory metropolitan feminism and socialism was crushed and silenced because the hierarchy of oppression was used all the time to say, sorry, you're not allowed to speak because I'm more oppressed than you are, and anything that you say is just oppressing me further. And who was doing all this? It were the women's committees, the black and minority ethnic, when they weren't called that then, black politics, etc. Meanwhile, patriarchy, the white establishment, continued to thrive. So I think there's a real danger in reinventing identity politics. Call it by different names, but I think we have to be very careful that we don't go back to that, where we silence each other. And I think this issue about young women feeling constrained is a huge challenge to us all. And that's, I think it's been theorised now, there's a concept known as critical hope. So, and we're aware, and I think when Valerie and I talked at the Robbins Committee, we did a Pollyanna and Cassandra double act. There's a real danger, I think, that when we start to deconstruct the academy, as we have been doing today, that people are left in despair at the end of it. Like, where is the counter-hegemonic space? And I think we have to balance that with some sense of critical hope, which I understand is being beautifully theorised in South Africa, where they really need that construct.
Yeah, I think that's one of the things neoliberalism has effectively done: strip out hope, you know, evacuate the social, construct everything as a competition, construct us as, you know, individuals, and if we're lucky, we have hard-working families behind us. And that stripping out of sociality, interdependency, love, I'm very struck by Mary's written a book called A Non-Romantic Discussion of Love, and it's kind of about the overprivileging of the kind of souped-up heterosexual desiring machine and commodification, and talking about loving in more dispersed, complex, subtle ways to do with friendships, defensible work relationships with people, the epistemic communities of feminism, and that's not to romanticise them, it's to talk about the conditions of possibility. I mean, I suspect, and Carol Leith was here, a member of Feminists Against Academic Bollocks, etc. I mean, the thing that kept us going was the love for each other, actually, and friendship, and getting drunk a few times helped. That got us on stage, and getting drunk got us on the next stage. And just sociality, just finding time for each other, finding time to be, seriously unserious, and to take the piss out of ourselves in a way. I mean, just to kind of do a pantomime, our life couldn't be more pantomime-like. I can't tell you the kind of days I look on my email box and I just want to crawl on the floor either with tears or laughter. I cannot believe it. I cannot believe yet another new demand to prove I've done what I said I've done and what they're paying me for. That kind of it's ludicrous. I mean, I like the ludic. I mean, it is ludicrous, some of the things we get asked to do to each other and are done to us. So I think exposing the irrationalities of this machine that's supposed to be about reason is, it's what feminists have always done. Simply by being there, turning up, you know, that really quite frightens people. I think we just got to do probably a bit more than now, turning up.
Barbara, would you like to?
Yeah, just to, I suppose one of the things that I didn't say about Barad is that a major part of her onto-epistemology, sometimes she puts the word ethical on it as well, so it has strong, there is a sense of political engagement in it as well, because the neoliberal strips out the political. Mm. It naturalises things, makes them seem normal and beyond contestation. Mm. But thinking of what Louise has done several times, and Valerie in the presentations as well, and it's part of my response to Barad and the power of language. Actually, I think that having concepts like critical hope, for example, we need vocabularies that we can use to contest in material ways. I mean, we're here as embodied people. So language is that we can speak back to these things with is important. And that's a generative thing. Yeah.
Okay, we're almost out of time, but I believe we have another question over here.
I'm French, so maybe I think there's some things I don't really understood. So maybe I will be a little bit beside sometimes, but. I would like to thank you very much. And just to say that I don't like also the privileged idea, because my problem with that is not that I know that I'm quite a privileged. I'm a university lecturer. I've got a tenure in France. In France, we still have tenure. But do I have to think that it is a privilege, that the idea with privilege is to break the privilege of others because you don't have them? My idea is much more to extend this situation to other people, because it's quite a normal situation, in fact. It would have to be a more normal situation and not a privileged situation. I think, I'm not sure to have understood, but there's a misunderstanding, and I don't absolutely not understood your presentation speaking about yourself as a problem of ego. But
probably.
I think because of Foucault, because of governing academic life, and because who are the people who speak, it's more and more, and even with students, I'm a university lecturer, so I've got students, I feel the need of speaking more and more about myself to my students. It's difficult, but because I don't want to personalize the question, to show how the how neoliberalism and social inequalities, how gender inequalities, and how bodies problematics are materialized and how it works. So I think it's very pedagogic, and not only for students but for speaking to and other people. And I think it's very difficult, the question you asked about the new, how I'm 40, I always have to count because I'm 47, and I'm not in the new generation, but I'm not in the old feminist or the generation of the 70s feminism either. I think it's very difficult and very important question, this new how to involve new generation for several reasons, at least two. One is the way the academic world works when you don't come from academic world, is that you feel quite free when you arrive and you think that, oh, feminism is not a struggle anymore. Oh, I thought that when I arrived in the academic world and the beginning of my tenure. And so you need time to realize that it's not absolutely true. And this is also with the interiorization of neoliberalism, because it's more and more difficult. It's also, and it's one of the rules of the game, but it's very difficult for a woman to realize that a lot of his internal tensions come from neoliberalism also, and come from gender question. And for me, I realized that I have to become feminist again when I touch with the power within university, because I was elected, I was department head of my department, and I was elected in different boards in my university. And also when you touch with power and when you touch with career questions, like becoming professor. And that's these things, when you realize that you are, that feminism is a real struggle now in academic life.
Okay, thanks for that. Any final comments or responses?
Well, we'd just like to thank you for our questions, and thanks for your attention. Do stay in touch with us. We have a very hyperactive website. We've got lots. Yeah, for the moment we're still in business. We have some reports here, and we'd welcome conversations with you about your struggles and your successes, so we can develop a lexicon about critical hope. I feel the need for that in more ways than one. Thank you.
Thanks to our chair.
And thank you so much to our panel.